This is a recording for the Taranaki Museum Oral History Program. I am about to take a walk of visitors around Brooklands Park, New Plymouth, and the date is the 9th of May 1999. We're recording on a Sony WM D6C cassette recorder using Sony ECM 144 microphone, microphone. It's being carried out in a mobile sense, and the recorder is being powered by batteries. I think I've mentioned my name is George Fuller, and this is tape number one, side one. Well, welcome everyone on again a lovely Sunday afternoon. We're gathered at the entrance to Brooklands Park, and it's our intention to go for a walk through the park and talk about some of the history and some of the plants that are there. Now, the reason I'm wired up like this is that this has been recorded for the oral history records of the Taranaki Museum. And so, in order to make that practical and functional, do what? You could ruin it. You probably will. if not, the miners will anyway, that we hear overhead. Anyway, to make this practical for future generations, I have to go to some trouble to explain where we are at a given time. It's no point in me saying, well, there's a tree over there and such and such. So we have to try and plot that both in terms of the tape, and Heather Allen is with us, and she has a map, and when I say something of any consequence, she will put an X on the map so that later people can relate to the tape and its contents. Now, at this point, I need to point out that this activity is organised by the Friends of the Park, who over the course of time have organised walks in various parts of the Pukekuren Brooklands, and we've sort of started from the north and we're travelling south, and we've now got as far as Brooklands. There's still one or two to do, and they will be undertaken in the future. Now, what I hope to do today is to go into Brooklands Park, the more recognised areas from here, the entrance. And then I'll take you on a little diversion once we've talked about the history of and the trees in the major and obvious part of the park. We'll diverge then and take off into what we call the Maranui Gully, which is the gully which runs virtually south from Brooklands Bowl towards Upjohn Street. And there's a bit of history in there, and there's certainly some trees of great significance. One of the objectives of this walk being May is to hopefully see some of the autumn colour. We're in an area of the country which is not notorious for autumn colour because we have such a mild and relatively moist climate. It's not conducive to good autumn colour formation. And in fact, some of the trees we see here, which sort of just we're not too critical, but just sort of almost a mushy greys and browns and that. In a harder climate, they would be spectacular colours. So anyway, there are a few exceptions to that, and I hope in one case in particular we will see that. So we'll now move on to the main lawn of Brooklands Park and talk about some of the interesting features there. Just before we go into the park, we're standing at the entrance looking down at the bowl of Brooklands, and I'm getting no response on the colour indicators on my recorder here. I just hope that it's being recorded. Just one moment. Now, panic station's out of the way. We're standing at the entrance to Brooklands Park, Brooklands Bowl, and looking down at the bowl, and I want you to notice the tree on the right Well, there's one tree immediately on the right of the sound shell, another one on this side of the lake, and also to the right of the seating. And I'm pointing them out because of their autumn colour. They are deciduous conifers, which is a little bit unusual. Both of them Taxodium disticum, which is the swamp cypress. I think we might have talked about them when we talked about the Bowl of Brooklyn, or visited the Bowl of Brooklands last time. Significant because they form, in their root system, they form sort of knees which arise above the water level and allow the root, which look like human knees almost, as far as I can remember, just at the water's edge, and they're quite significant for that tree. Autumn is starting to take hold on, and we see the chestnuts here, horse chestnuts, and the plane trees just starting to colour a little bit, but they never colour really spectacularly here. If we were in a harder climate, as I mentioned before, they would be quite spectacular colours. Now, just inside the gate on the right hand side, we come to the plaque which commemorates the handing over, that's not quite a good word, acquisition in 1933 of the park into the park system of New Plymouth. Prior to that, it had been privately owned, and this is a great difference, or one of the great differences between Pukekura Park and Brooklands. There was no area of Pukekura Park, with a few minor exceptions, which was ever privately owned. However, all of Brooklands Park at one time was privately owned. Originally, in 1841, when the town was being developed by the Plymouth Company, the second ship to arrive was the Amelia Thompson, and aboard was a retired naval man, Captain Henry King. In his retirement and his prestigious background, he became the magistrate, a senior magistrate, I think, of this area as the town developed. And as a consequence of his status, he didn't have to suffer the indignity of going into a ballot when the allocation of land took place. He was granted this 50 acres plus an extra 50 acres, two 50-acre sections before the peasantry went into the ballot, and that is the origin of Brooklands. It was named Brooklands, and Captain Henry King developed it as a farm and residence, and he developed it on rather a grand scale. I think it was only a year after he took possession of the land, he chartered a boat to go to Australia and brought back all sorts of goodies, including cattle and livestock for this farm. And it was on this farm that the first cheese was produced in this part of New Zealand. It seems that he also brought back some liquor. And would you believe, not long after he got back, he was arraigned by a group of magistrates for selling liquor without a license. So nothing changes, does it? A person in a position of responsibility and a magistrate at that. Anyway, he developed the residence and the gardens and was in residence for quite some time. However, in 1860, the land wars evolved, and because Brooklands was outside of the area which could reasonably be defended, it was abandoned. And we find later a very interesting outcome of that, because there is a fireplace further into the park which is the only remnant of the original house that Captain Henry King built. Now, I should have put some notes down on dates, but somewhere about 1870-something, Captain Henry King died, and the occupancy was carried on by his brother-in-law, Cutfield, who subsequently also died. And in 1888, Newton King, there's a very strange coincidence that a king should follow a king in ownership of the property, but no relative, Newton King, who subsequently became a very important person in the commercial field in New Plymouth, purchased the land and developed it, especially as a wonderful garden area. Now, he appointed a gardener, had a gardener as such, and I think there were several, at one stage, several gardeners. And this became one of the great gardening properties, certainly in this part of New Zealand and to some extent throughout New Zealand, had a great reputation. And one of the big events of those days was when the garden, private garden, was opened to visitors. And we had Pukekura Park adjoining, and the race course just on the other side of the Maranui Gully. At that time, it had wonderful gardens too, and the big event of those days was for Pukekura Park, always open to the public, of course, Brooklands Park, and the race course, all open to visitors at a time of the year when the gardens were at their best. So it was a circuit walk to whichever way you went, you picked up the three gardens. Now, in addition to that, we'll find there was a fourth garden, which was of some significance, down in the Maranui Gully. Not very few people seem to know about it now, but it's my intention today to visit the List, what was previously the List property down in the Maranui Gully. And by coincidence, we see here on this plaque, says Brooklands, the gift to New Plymouth of Newton King Esquire, incorporated in Pukekura Park, 1933. It doesn't mention the fact that the valley, which was the property of List, and Mr. Wilkinson also donated a piece of land down in the Maranui Gully also. And they are very, very significant, although not so obvious. They're very significant parts of land, areas of land, as far as this park system is concerned. So I want to enlighten you on that as we go along. Now, we've progressed into the park only about, 50 metres less, probably 40 metres. So we're not going very fast, and that's typical of my progression, I suppose, through a park. And we're standing on the lawn on the right-hand side as you enter the gate. And already the significance of the trees is becoming very evident. Somebody just mentioned the wonderful trunk of a rhododendron elegans behind us. And somebody asked about the planting dates of some of these trees. They do go back to the 1840s of the Captain Henry King plantings, and Newton King is known to have put in an enormous number of plantings too. But these really big significant trees, like the Norfolk pines above us, and even this rhododendron elegans, although it's only, 7-8 metres tall, it would still be a planting from about the 1880s, probably. Could have been before a little bit. Just the difference in the growth rate. But just beside us here is a plant which is barely, it is a little bit higher than me, which doesn't say very much, but it is of equal significance to these massive trees that we see around us, because this is one of the very early rhododendron species from which the rhododendron mollusk group were hybridized. You're going to ask me what its name is, and I can't tell you at the moment. But in terms of horticultural history, this tree, although it's only a metre and a bit high, less than 2 metres high, it is of considerable significance. And somebody's pointed out just beyond towards the zoo on the right-hand side here, the top of a great macrocarpa, the Cupressus macrocarpa, or the Monterey cypress. We'll go towards it in a moment, but significant, as I mentioned, out, we better have a longing look at it, because it's had a lot of tree surgery done in higher parts, and it's really an indication that the root system is slowly declining, and I don't think we'll be seeing that particular tree for very long. I must tell you about a little trick I played several years ago. Also on this front lawn, you'll see a very horizontal and pendulous cherry tree. On the boundary between Brooklands Park and the bowl, the sound shell itself, there is now a Camellia sasanqua hedge. In earlier days, that wasn't there. And by standing on the top of this cherry, you could get a wonderful view of the stage of the bowl of Brooklands. And many of the locals were quite aware of that. And when there were big performances at the bowl, they used to climb up there and just sit on those beautiful horizontal branches, to the detriment of the tree, I hasten to say.
Did you climb up the tree?
Oh, you didn't need to in those days. You could virtually see the bowl from here. In fact, they put screens up at one stage, Hessian screens. But I discouraged that by, before performances, going up and smarming heavy grease. Gordon will know what cart grease is on the branches up there. I'm mainly concerned about the health and welfare of that beautiful tree. Now, we've progressed a little further towards the macrocarpa. I haven't quite got there yet. But we're standing under a native tree, which is often sort of bypassed. But it has some very interesting features. It's the koikoi, or Dicyoxylum spectabile, if you want the botanical name. And it's interesting for a number of reasons. It's a true member of the mahogany family and has very, very beautiful wood. Well, now, it's not always consistently good, and it's very difficult to get a really good piece of it. So it's never been regarded as a choice timber tree in New Zealand, but nevertheless, the wood is very beautiful in the mahogany sense. But it has this unusual characteristic of the flower racemes, and they finish up looking like sort of racemes of lily of the valley, but they emerge from hard wood. They come out of the bark, not on the ends, you know, where the leaves are, but they emerge on older parts of the stem. And if you look back right into the base of the tree, where it's it's sort of 40 centimetres in diameter, there are still masses of flower spikes coming out all along the stems. Yes, right on the main trunk, you'll see it never seems to lose the capacity to send out flower stems, and that is a very unusual condition. You don't see that in many trees. These are followed by, we're seeing buds now, but the next phase is the little flowers open. They're not very spectacular. As I say, they're like small lily of the valley flowers. And then they're followed by fruits, which to all intents and purposes look like sort of small walnuts.
I see them lying in there in the
tree. Yes, and they have quite pretty seeds in them.
So that's
the koikoi, which is it looks very much like the puriri, and a lot of people confuse it with puriri and probably don't look at it closely for that reason. The leaves are compound, like the puriri, that is to say they have a midrib and several small leaflets come off it. But you can always tell the difference very quickly between a koikoi and a puriri stem, because in the puriri, the leaves come off the stem opposites and alternates. In other words, one set of leaves will come off at 12 o'clock, 6 o'clock, the next will come off at 3 o'clock, 9 o'clock. Then we go back to 12 o'clock, 6 o'clock again, an alternate.
Yes.
You're going to ask me about summertime.
know a tree could tell the time.
Oh, I'm getting myself into trouble here. Well, we now have progressed to the giant Macrocarpa or Monterey cypress, which is close to the zoo, and we're standing under this magnificent canopy with roosters crowing and everybody else crowing too about the size of the buttress. Burstall, who was an expert on timber production, estimated that this would be this trunk would be the largest volume of Macrocarpa timber anywhere. Now, it comes from the Monterey area of California, and I just love to bring Californians here and show them this magnificent specimen. They just cannot associate it with the tree that grows in Monterey, where, understandably, the growth is not so impressive because they only have about 14 inches of rainfall a year there, so it's in a totally different climate here. But a magnificent tree, and it'll be a great sadness. We can see at the base of the tree here, rot starting to set in, and the fact that if you look up at the canopy, the ends of the branches are dying obviously, and that's a bad sign. There was another tree just on the other side of the toilet there up until a couple of years ago, not as large as this one, but a very large one, and it died. So together with some of the other trees, it looks as if in our climate these trees grow magnificently for about 100 years. By about 120, 130 years seems to be their lifespan. They have just assumed the maximum possible bulk that they can be, and they start to deteriorate from there.
So in California, they live longer, would they?
Yes, they'd probably live longer, yes, so, and grow much, much slower, yes, yeah. Yes, they cling to the banks.
Could we grow a tree like that now, in 100 years?
Oh, yeah. It happens to have been a very good specimen, and this is one of the problems of Macrocarpa as a timber tree. It has been planted for timber, but in years gone by, the quality in timber terms of the trunks has been so low that it's been very disappointing in some respects. It is being grown as a timber tree, a hardwood, and the selective strains, as with Pinus radiata, selective strains have been developed, and they are timber. But many stands of Macrocarpa from the past have just about been useless because you'll notice in the trunk here the fluting. Now, that is not a good characteristic. If you think of a kauri tree which goes up with a beautiful cylindrical trunk with no blemishes or anything in it, you can imagine that if you start to mill that trunk for timber, there's an enormous amount of wastage before you get into timber that you can saw into planks. It's just, and if you imagine that in a smaller tree, and sometimes the fluting can go into sort of a quarter of its depth, so straight away you're losing 50% of the potential of that tree. But Macrocarpa is being recognised now as a very desirable tree, timber that is, and would you believe it's often called a Taranaki kauri. Because if you get good quality Macrocarpa timber without knots in it, it looks very, very similar to the kauri.
It's good on the outside of it, and it goes grey.
Yes, it's quite a desirable tree. That's why it was grown so widely in earlier days. It was put in on farms and hedgerows and that to provide shelter and subsequently to provide fence posts. It can be split relatively well, and that's one thing, but the more important thing is that it was reasonably durable in the ground.
Yes.
So it had a quality of for fencing, which of course was a very vital thing in early days. Now we're moving out onto the main lawn a little bit from the zoo. The zoo is behind us, and walking towards a very, very large specimen of the copper beech, European copper beech. Now, it's easy to assess here the significance of Brooklands Park in its concept. This is a layout which would be characterised by European landscaping, where you have lawns. They could be flower beds, and they were in the earlier days a lot more flower beds, but big expansive lawns with specimen trees set on it, and not overplanted, very wide spacing between the trees. There would have been a lot more trees in here at one time probably, but the major trees have space between them, so you get this beautiful effect, park-like, in the European sense of specimen trees set out on lawns. Now, as pointed out, there were several gardeners here in earlier days, and this was a very, very fine property. The standard of gardening here was very, very high indeed. Now, in 1933, when it was became the responsibility of the town council of the day, this was a fairly remote spot, and we can see across the main drive the relics of the first house. Now, it was built in 1841, I think, the original house. Could have been 1842, but anyway, and it was about that time, and it was built to the European design, where they had this wonderful big fireplace. We can see it closer later, but it's a good point to talk about it from here. And it would have had a chimney, and in the back of it there is a baker's oven, where quite separate to the big fireplace, but accessed from the same hearth, and they would have fired up that separately to heat the stones of which it's formed, and then raked out all the ashes and put the bread in to bake. So that was the principle of it. Now, in the 1860s, I pointed out that this was outside the protected areas, and it was subsequently burnt down by the Maoris, and that's all that's left of the original house. When the disputes were over, and the Captain Henry King came back, a big double-storied house was built, again on the other side of the drive, but sort of to the north, towards New Plymouth, from the old fireplace, and it looked out over the bowl of Brooklands. We'll talk about that later when we get there. But so that's a little bit of the history here in this area. So the glass house, which was up until the 1970s, the top house, house number 4 at the Fernries in Pukekura Park, was actually shifted from here after the house, and that was what I was getting to, the house was pulled down. But let's go to the glass house now. I've started on that. When the main house here was dismantled, the glass house was shifted here to the Fernries at Pukekura Park. You've got to realise that originally the Fernries at Pukekura Park were only three Fernries. Those three sunken houses were all that existed there until the mid-1930s, when this house was shifted down, and it became more of a conservatory where they grew a lot of other plants. Now, the dismantling of the house here, which has outraged a lot of people in recent times, but it would never be permitted now, I suppose, would it, Ron? But you've got to visualise New Plymouth in 1933, when it became the responsibility of the council to administer. It's pretty remote. It wasn't on a tourist route for a start. There was no bowl of Brooklands. There was no zoo. It was just Brooklands residence. It was a big two-storied house, and a very immaculate garden. And there was just no way that the council could in any way justify upkeeping that place in the manner in which it had been kept. And in their wisdom, they decided to dismantle the house. So that was how things. I mean, it seems a crazy thing to do when we look back at it. Oh, the other thing was that it was just after a very, very serious depression anyway. The big depression of the late 1920s, they were just starting to recover from that. And so the council would have been, in those days, in no way financially able to sustain the house as it was. Don't forget that even the origin of Pukekura Park was not to be a drain on the ratepayers of New Plymouth of the day in the 1870s. So not surprising, perhaps, that, but sadly, the house was demolished shortly after it was
taken. I remember seeing that house just a youth.
Yes. Mm. It'd be about 1933,
yes,
probably.
Yes, it was the early
30s. Yeah.
George, they didn't give it a go, though.
Yeah. This is Ron Lambert from the music director of the museum. Sorry, Ron. Ron is just giving us a little bit of historical background here that I'd like to hear, too.
I was reading an account in the 30s newspaper just at the time they made that decision the other day.
Yes.
And in fact, they did give it a real good crack because one of the things they were looking at using it for was some sort of botanical museum. Botanical museum, but
relating it to Pukekura Park.
And there was another couple of proposals that they did actually look at. So it wasn't quite
blasé. Now, I'm sure. This is side 2 of tape 1, and we're now standing on the site of the famous big sweet chestnut, Castanea sativa. Now, we've left one of our members behind. He's the most vociferous of them, so we've got rid of him for a little while, and he is standing at what would have been the other edge of this big tree. The trunk would have been halfway between here and that sole in the distance there. It was about just over 40 meters in diameter, in span. And you can come now, so long as you shut up and keep quiet. I just measured that out to give you. It's very, very difficult for people to realize how big that tree was. It must have been the biggest sweet chestnut in the world. Yes, I suppose at some stage, yes, to give an indication of it. 200 people were served, afternoon tea under it in the days of the Newton Kings when they had garden parties and that here. So you can see what an enormous tree. In fact, I've sent a photograph round and you'll gain some idea of the size. And it was so big that we had to put a sign out in front there towards the pathway that this was the big chestnut, because people would sort of come and look at it and think, oh, there's a sort of a forest, you know. And we had to actually put a sign there so that in the summer people would realise that they were standing beside the big chestnut. Yes.
And the branch is just sitting.
Yes. For quite some time after it died. It died about 1977. Would have been planted in the 1840s. It died in 1977. And because it was such a significant tree, we cut it back and left the trunk there for good many years until it rotted. Just, you know, as a reminder of its wonderful size. Just behind it, towards the sort of bush line, with a big number 10 underneath it, that is Magnolia solangiana. Now, although that's nowhere near the size of what the chestnut was, that's probably one of the largest Magnolia solangianas in the country. It's a really spectacular sight in the spring when the magnolia flowers are open. Again, that would be a lovely autumn tree in an area where there was hard frosts and cold, dry conditions at night.
So see the way the branches have come out there at the end?
Yes.
And they're all willowy, wispy looking. Should they be cut off, or is that just the way the tree is,
that is a character of the tree. When you see it with no leaves on it, that sort of zigzaggy density of branches is a character of the tree, which you won't get in many other trees.
Yeah.
And because of that, it bears so many, many flowers. Yeah. You know, all that fine branching at the ends of the leaves. Yeah. And that zigzag branching habit is, you know, quite a characteristic of the structure of the tree. We're standing underneath a young sweet chestnut, incidentally, which I think was a seedling from the major tree. When it started to die, we tried to layer the branches went right out and touched the ground, and we tried to layer them, but it wasn't successful. Sorry?
Is it where the trunk was?
No, it was way out in the middle there. This is an attempt to spray up kakia grass in the lawn here. Brooklands used to be famous for its wonderful lawns. But I don't think that would be a characteristic of this day and age. It's carried by mowers. Forestenberg, here we go. He's going to tell me mowers are extinct, I'm sure. We have Ian Barry. I have to apologise to those on the tape. We have Ian Barry with us.
Would it be in the boots and the soles of runners that it keeps?
It could be, especially slow runners.
But the speed, we go in
and lose. Oh, yes. You'd never transmit it, would you?
Wouldn't have time to.
Anyway, let's be serious for a moment. Behind the chestnut, again against the bush line there, and of course this bush line is another special feature of Brooklands Park. In their great wisdom, they cleared a site for the house and gardens, and they took out. There's records of timber being taken from here and being sold, you know, to leave a fringe of native bush right round this area, and the farm was beyond it, over towards Somerset Street. And so we have this wonderful foil of native trees in the background, and all these, you'll notice that most of the trees in here are deciduous. So you have the extremes of totally evergreen and totally deciduous, the one thrown up against the other. And I was just going to mention that liquid amber, that big liquid amber there against the bush line there. Now, again, that should be an absolutely brilliant autumn tree. And, in fact, you won't have time today probably, but down in the Truby King Dell, which is just down at the Brooklands Road, Brooklands Drive intersection on the other side of the road, there are some liquid ambers at the moment. They are looking very beautiful indeed. All leaf colours from dark purple to pale cream. And because the liquid amber is one of the trees that's marginally good for autumn colour in this area, dependent on the particular site. Now, the big lawn in front of us here, the big lawn with a circular bed in the front, kept open deliberately to feature the expanse and an opportunity to use carpet bedding. And as we go round toward, we're looking south now from the where the old chestnut was. We move round towards, must be east, mustn't it, over that side. Any corrections? We look towards what was the surface area, the sheds and garages and so on for the house. And in that area we have one walnut tree remaining. There were at one stage two, and one died only within the last 12 months, I think, certainly the last 2 years. And there used to be another chestnut in that area there. So many of these old trees, you know, they've passed their time. Also, near in this area where we're standing, where the big chestnut was, there used to be a very large maple tree, the common Acer palmatum, a very large tree. That died too, not very long after that. So a whole series of very old trees have just deteriorated and died.
And they were all 200 years old, were they?
Oh, no, not 200, about 120, roughly, in that age group. But not only were they dying here in Brooklands Park, I have records of them dying in outlying areas around New Plymouth also. Trees of about the same age and of the same species, particularly. The Norfolk pines were planted about the 1851 area, 52, I think. And there was a whole, there seemed to have, at that time, some nursery had access to Norfolk pine seed, and not only in New Plymouth, but that you can date a lot of the early plantings of Norfolk pines to that time. We're being buzzed by a fantail now. Incidentally, in connection with the Norfolk pine, you'll find it in quite a number of early missionary stations of those sort of 1840s, 50s, and probably not 1840s, but 1850s. And it was taken by the missionaries because if you visualise the top, the very growing point, it has the character of a cross. It has the great habit of a cross. And it was sort of regarded as a little bit of a significant tree in religious circles for that reason. And, you know, places like Tauranga, you'll find them in the old mission stations and quite a number of places of that time. We're standing beside a very large specimen of... we're still on the lawn, not far from the site of the old chestnut, and a Camellia japonica of quite considerable size here. And these, again, would have gone back to those early plantings of probably the 1850s. And on, as we look back towards the main entrance, as we're looking now due north, we see a fan palm. And that also, although it's not a big, very significant plant in terms of bulk, it would relate to those early years also. There used to be another one on the other side, on the lawn on the other side of the path, until one day one of our staff was doing some job. He wasn't one of the gardeners from this area, I have to point out, but... he was doing some work, I think repairing the paths or something, or repairing the beds. Anyway, doing something with a utility, and had to back it, and suddenly there was a crash. And his vehicle was wearing one of these fan palms draped across the bonnet. He'd backed into it, and it snapped off like a carrot. So that was a quick end to a rather notable fan palm. Right, now we're standing right in front of the old fireplace. There's a plaque on there which gives a little bit of its history. You can see what a solid structure it was. It would have been built and then, you know, the house built around it probably. And you can actually stand in it, and just above your head there, there's a very solid steel rail, upon which they would have hung their pots and hams and whatever. It would have had a big chimney going up there. Of course, the chimney has fallen down years ago, and on several occasions people have tried to demolish what we have, little we have left anyway. Some work was done in my time, and I think some since, to try and retain the top. There's a little bit more concrete work being done there because it was crumbling. Sorry?
The Mary's hasn't claimed.
No. And you see the steel bar across the front here, which is now almost rusted through. Now, that was a critical part of the structure for keeping the arch, which kept the whole thing intact. So I'm not quite sure what's going to happen about it. But you will see from... Yeah, that is a real problem, yes. In the back, you'll see the opening for the baker's oven where, as I said, they used to fire it up and then rake the ashes out into the hearth here and put the bread in and close it up, because bread baking was a slow, steady heat that was required. Now, we're looking sort of southeast, and you can see the remnants of the gardener's shed over there. Above it, a very large rhododendron, Sir Robert Peel, which is a tree often found in gardens of the 1880s. It was a rhododendron that came as a hybrid, but a very, very vigorous hybrid. That came out in about that time, and so you find it in a lot of gardens. Between us and the shed the fireplace still. Between us and the shed, there was, up until last year, as I say, another walnut tree, a second walnut tree, and there was also, prior to that, just by a couple of years, another chestnut tree, a sweet chestnut tree, but they have both gone. Beyond the rhododendron, you'll see a deciduous tree just taking colour. Now, believe it or not, that is the scarlet oak. And I was looking at a scarlet oak in Lepperton area this morning, really taking on beautiful colours, but I think you'll agree there's nothing special about that. But that's a North American oak and a very, very spectacular autumn-coloured tree. If you went down to Queenstown, that would be one of the really dramatic, bright, bright scarlet reds of autumn. But a little bit disappointing here. Now, we happen to be standing beside a second, in fact, it's a third, but in terms of size, it looks like a second copper beech. And somebody asked about the colourings of it. Now, the copper beech has various forms. The big one, which we passed between here and the zoo, is the ordinary Fagus sylvatica purpurea, the ordinary copper beech. This one we're looking at here, or we're close to here, is Fagus sylvatica river's eye. What did I say first? Did I say cuprea? Fagus sylvatica cuprea. Sorry, that's the big one, the first one we passed. We're now looking at Fagus sylvatica river's eye, which is a very dark form of the copper beech. But looking at it now, it doesn't look copper. It's a feature that only exists through the spring. And back towards the gate, that is towards almost the north from here, you'll see a young tree coming up underneath, almost underneath the, a little bit to the side of the Norfolk Pines. Now, that is another form of copper beech. Fagus sylvatica swat migrae. And it's a rare form, but it is a copper one. And there used to be a very big specimen of it at the gate. You used to walk under it as you came in through the main gate there. It died several years ago, but fortunately one of the propagating staff was able to take a piece of it and get a young one to grow. Now, the significance of these three copper beeches is that one, Swat migrae, comes out first. It's the first in which the purple leaves emerge. Then about a week or 10 days later, we have the big ordinary copper beech on the main lawn. And then third and darkest of all is this river's eye. So there's a sequence of three copper beeches, both in terms of time, you know, sort of maturity, and in terms of colour also. Now we've just moved north from the fireplace. We're still on the main lawn and we're sort of walking roughly towards Pukekura Park, and we're standing beside a low shrub which doesn't look like much, especially at the moment, because it seems to have lost a lot of its leaves. It's trying to flower. Does anybody guess, or do they know the significance of that plant? It's a big spreading plant on the lawn. What is it, about nearly 10 metres across? This is commercial tea, yeah, a camellia, Camellia sinensis, or Camellia thea, or there's about four or five names, Camellia bohea, I think. This is the true tea, and what would happen in when the tea production areas, they would just pick these little tips off the stems and dry them, and that would be the tea leaves that we would get. And if you wondered, what do they call it, China buds? Is there a tea, China buds? They are formed of these little flower buds, dried. It's another form of tea. And, of course, the Japanese have fresh tea. You know, they don't dry it. They have to have it. And that is now in commercial production in New Zealand, I believe. But it has to be, you know, exported immediately.
It's quite
to export. Sorry? What? To Japan, yeah. There's a demand for it in Japan. Green tea.
Commercial ones, I just keep low like a hedge.
Yes, well, that's why they look like hedges, because they're trimming them all the time. They're just taking the tips out of them. Mm.
Well,
now, again, we're standing beside this big wide bush of camellia, or tea, if you like, and we're looking north towards Pukekura Park, and we have this expansive lawn which has nothing in it. And that is where the second house was built, this two-storied house that we're talking about having been dismantled in about 1934 when the park came under the jurisdiction of the parks of the council of the day. So the lawn has never been it's never been planted up. It's still sort of bearing the you can't see anything, but it's bearing the significance of that house. And being a two-storied house, you see, they would have looked down into the dell beyond, which is the location of the Bowl of Brooklands. Yes, now we've moved a little bit further towards sort of Pukekura, Bowl of Brooklands, in other words, north from the fireplace. We're still on the main lawn, and we're standing beside a bed of rather strange-looking palm-like plants, and in one bed anyway. And these are cycads. They have massive big cones, which are their fruiting bodies. They have an extremely complex pollinating system, which I can't remember detail, and I won't try to explain at the moment, but very slow-growing plants and very desirable. In Auckland, these plants would fetch hundreds, possibly into the thousands of dollars of this size. And in fact, they're so valuable in the Auckland area that a lot of people serious about keeping them have implanted microchips in them, so that should they be stolen, they'll be able to locate them and identify them again. Now, it sounds absolutely ludicrous, but it is in fact so. They transport. I mean, believe me, in Auckland, they have come in with front end loaders and stolen them to order. Stolen them to order. It's quite a worrying factor up there. But they are very prehistoric in their sort of growth, their methods of propagation and so on. But very spectacular. Associated with them are a range of succulent plants like yuccas and agaves and so on. Just to show how beautiful these cycads can be, look at the one in the end of that bed there. Now, you'd think it was a palm, but it is one of this cycad group. Look what an elegant and beautiful thing it is. And, I mean, these are growing in pretty exposed sites. You can imagine if that was in a walled garden. I actually have one myself similar to that, not quite that one. I'm not saying anything. If we now turn around, shut up, Wilson. putting the skids under me. obviously got to be very careful what I say.
It's all being recorded too. Goodness me.
Shut up. looking to the north, further, we have... You'll find it hard to believe that that is a cowrie. That is the oddest, one of the oddest shaped cowries you'll ever see anywhere. Cowrie is notorious for its wonderful, strong, upright trunks with no branches on until it's gone up a long way. This one has branched at about 1.5 metres into, 8 or 9 heads, and they've subsequently branched further. It's just the characteristic of that particular seedling. It's what they call bull-headed, you know. It's gone into major branches, because the characteristic of the cowrie tree is that young branches normally will just shear off. They drop off very readily, and so the tree goes up to gain height over its competition. Not always. Yeah, that does have effect.
Because once inside the gate of where we go in, up the driveway, Shortland Street there, they've got more light and they have got more branches on.
Yes, it will tend to be that. that way. It's not entirely pure. There are exceptions to that rule. But this, of course, was certainly, I agree, in an open site, which would tend to make it spread. Mm. But you can also get specimens that are growing solitary, and they will go straight up, and you know, characteristic of the cowrie. So it's a little bit of a mystery. Beside it, we have one of the magnolias, and it's a very pretty one. I think it might be Sargentiana robusta. Yes, and I have yes. Ian has just mentioned that pigeons like it. You'll see all the tips of the branches that are a little bit dilapidated. It's a great source of food for pigeons. I have seen nine in that at one time, nine pigeons. Needless to say, Ian Barry here has seen 10. So I never ever dared mention to Alan Jellyman, who's a great lover of magnolias and was responsible for planting that one and many others in the park. I never had the courage to tell him that I'd seen nine pigeons in it. They might have been pigeon traps all over the place.
Where
did cycads come from? Cycads are very widely distributed through the drier parts of the southern hemisphere, from Australia, South Africa. There will be for a given species. You're going to ask me which. These are Cycas revoluta, I think.
How long have they been here?
They were planted in the 70s, I think, this bed. We planted that. And these true Pseudopanax ferox were commemorative trees, one planted by Mrs. Elliot King and one by Fred Parker. I think there was a third one that might have been planted by Russell Matthews at a commemorative planting. I think it was in the 1970s. Mm. Yeah, that's the lancewood, you know, but not the common one. No, not the more common one, the ferox form. One of them has died, and that one looks as if it's not too happy. Fred Parker donated these because at that time there were very few sources of Pseudopanax ferox, and he had a tree that produced seedlings, and so he was able to supply seed.
Who was she planted?